Hello everyone, this is Space Cafe Podcast and I am Marcus. So is Germany preparing to revive its crippled auto industry, perhaps with a foray into space? Well, as we know, predictions are hard to make, especially when they concern the future, someone once said. But who knows? Something has been brewing in Bavaria for a couple of years that has the potential to do what SpaceX has succeeded in doing in the United States, namely to radically upend an entire industry. And of course, you know who I'm talking about, right? ESAR Aerospace has been the talk of town at least since the company raised 75 million euros in its latest round of financing with the help of Porsche, among others.
I think we will do something extraordinary, to be honest.
And this voice belongs to no other than Stella Gillen, the commercial director of ESA Aerospace.
I think we'll do it, and we'll do it faster than what we are used to see in Europe. That's my strong belief. Yeah.
It's time to take a closer look at the company, shall we? Stella Gillen has had a stellar, well, that had to be, career. Was part of SpaceX in the early years and finds ESAR Aerospace exciting enough to pull up stakes overseas and come to Munich. Welcome, Stella Gillen. Stella, before we get going, you have some very serious biography to offer. I mean, like this, it seems like it's space only. Let me just fire this up again. This is pretty, very impressive. So let me just read this again. Hold on a second. LinkedIn, that was Stella.
And we don't have to go back in time, do we? Like long time, that's going to tell a lot.
No. We're not going to be doing this, but let me just for the audience. So hold on, dear audience, fasten your seatbelts. Let's go back to 2004. So Intelsat was even 1995. Intelsat, then New Skies, Veristar, SES Americom, SpaceNet, Space Exploration Technologies, Spaceflight Industries, ArianeSpace, and now ESA Aerospace. Seriously, you seem to have been born for the space thing, right?
You know, I tell you a funny story. When I was looking for a job, just graduated from university, I actually applied for Intelsat and another company. And I got a job on this other company, but I was still interviewing with Intelsat because the first time I went to the Intelsat building, this is in Washington, D.C., I walked into the lobby and I saw this, you know, mock-ups of the satellites hanging from the ceiling. And I was totally in shock. I'd never seen anything like it. I didn't know anything about space or, you know, satellites or anything like that. And the first thing they did, I remember, they took us to a little auditorium, very tiny auditorium they had in there. And they gave us a movie of sort of the space industry and what Intelsat was doing at the time. And I just fell in love with that. It was just, I wanted to work in that building. And that's, you know, a few months later, weeks later, I received the okay to start there. And that's how everything started.
Yeah. Wow. So have you ever, was it always clear which direction you wanted to be headed towards when it comes to the space industry? Because I mean, like some people go into engineering, some people go into astronautics, some people go into this and that. So was it always clear, or were you free floating in the early days?
Oh my God. I never had it clear, to be honest. I was a ballet dancer. I was professionally a ballet dancer for many years. And
of course you were. I mean, like, what else would you
My passion was dance. And when I was not doing great physically, I had a lot of issues with my knees and other things. And I was doing my master's, not my master's. I was actually thinking about doing a master's degree and in business. That's the other thing that kind of caught my attention back then. That I really didn't know where I was going, what to do. Pretty much lost, besides knowing that I wanted to dance. When dance was not there anymore, I had no idea what to do. And I started applying for jobs that were directed to international people, because I thought, okay, where can I use my languages? And, you know, this is the thing that I have to offer. And at the time, Intelsat was an international organization. So I actually was working, I was the receptionist at a temp agency back then. And they brought me one of the accounts was Intelsat, and I was looking at it, and I thought, oh my God, this is an international organization. Literally, it just came by pure coincidence that I fell in love with the building, fell in love with satellites, and Intelsat was actually a great company for me, because I found some of my mentors in the industry there, and they pushed me to study and to, you know, to get my master's degree, and they trained me there. So I'm very, very thankful for that start, because that's how my other passion started. Yeah.
Nice.
But no, I had no clue. No clue.
So you just mentioned briefly that you wanted to find a place where you can make use of your languages. So what languages can you offer?
So I was born in Peru. So I have Spanish, and my mother is Brazilian. My father's Peruvian, grew up in both countries. So Portuguese and Spanish were my languages besides English. So I wanted to be able to offer that. Yeah.
Wow. And now, fast forward a couple of years, now you're in Bavaria. Isn't that, I mean, like, that's pretty
but
much
But don't ask about my German.
No. Is seriously, as an Austrian, I can say this, but the question is German spoken in Bavaria, or is this a different kind of language? So I'm entitled to say this, because we make fun of one another. But you're in Bavaria, you're in Munich, that is, and you're with ESA Aerospace. What made you go to Bavaria to team up with ESA Aerospace?
So I actually was, to be honest, I missed the startup sort of mode of doing business in space. I enjoyed my time at SpaceX a lot. It was the beginning of the Falcon 9, so I had great memories. And I wanted to contribute also to the European space side of things. I've been working with Europe for a long time, and I saw the opportunity of what a commercial, forward company could do on the micro launcher side. And I was approached by ESAR, Björn Olten, which is one of the founders of ESAR. I knew Björn from SpaceX time, and when he and I talked about it, and he explained to me what ESAR was doing, and then I met the team, Daniel and everybody else on the team. I really fell in love with what their perception of what Europe needs, and also how they are managing it to do it. The understanding that a company starts with a piece, a blank piece of paper in 2018, and that they have a target to launch next year. It really excited me. I mean, that's just, yeah. So I was in, immediately. I mean, this is just the whole idea of actually making a difference and being competitive in the marketplace. That's something that I really wanted to be part of. So I didn't question it too much, to be honest. It was perfect.
Absolutely. You're mentioning SpaceX. I didn't catch that on your LinkedIn profile. So what did you do there?
So I was doing business development. I was in charge of the European market and was there almost 6 years and went through the whole first launch of Falcon 9 through the beginnings of Falcon 9. So that excitement that I had back then, I'm having it now as well. It's obviously different because the market is different now than it was back then. But it's sort of the same feeling, you know, of being in a startup. Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. So let's talk about ESA Aerospace, your new employer. So ESA Aerospace is, and please do correct me, is not one of the, but maybe the hottest startup all over Europe when it comes to producing or designing in, rockets to get smaller satellites into orbit. It got pretty heavily funded very recently. So what's the secret sauce? What's going on here?
I actually think we are definitely the hardest one, and we are the most funded space startup in Europe. So super proud to say that. I think the secret sauce is the team that we have behind ESAR and the way we are building the vehicle. I think there's a market. There's no question about it. I mean, there's a market of the small satellites. It's true that there's a lot of launch service providers also coming up, but a lot of them are on a design mode, sort of a PowerPoint presentation. And the fact that we are so quickly from, like I said, from a blank piece of paper to building a factory and actually producing, I mean, anybody that visits our factory, it's wowed by it because it is real and you can see, you know, things coming out of that factory, equipment coming out. So I think that's the secret sauce, the fact that we are actually doing what we, you know, we are set to do. And the team is amazing. I mean, very, very young team, but super smart and hardworking people. So I think that's definitely the secret sauce.
So let's please do excuse that comparison, but let's say SpaceX is still the gold standard internationally when it comes to innovative rocket technology. So could you compare ESA Aerospace now to SpaceX so that we get an understanding what kind of rockets you produce as opposed to what SpaceX is doing? Maybe let's talk about payload so that we get a feeling, because I mean, like most of our of the people also in the audience here, we have seen quite a bit of SpaceX launches. We've shed tears also, I guess, when they did their crazy things and fell into each other's arms after successful launches. And unsuccessful launches, that is. So let's quickly or try to compare ESA Aerospace to SpaceX to get a feeling for what your company is all about.
Sure. I think we are in the same position of sort of breaking the paradigms of the space industry in Europe as SpaceX did in the US, right? With ULA being the anchor launch service provider for the government there. We are in a similar position as Arianespace is the launch service provider in Europe right now, established, I should say. So in that comparison, we are kind of breaking that market right now. The way ESAR is pursuing the commercial market is, it's very similar to what SpaceX did back in the US in, mm-hmm. a few years ago. We are starting with the Spectrum, which is a vehicle that is 1 ton, capacity to LEO. That's where we see the most immediate market, and also the way we could learn, quickly, on the vehicle and the system, right? So this is also kind of similar to what a Falcon 1 was back then. That actually Falcon 1, the market was very similar, but it was too early for the market back then. And mm-hmm. that's why it, you know, it didn't progress. And then they went up to a Falcon 9. But, on ESA's side, we believe that there is a market for a Spectrum, mm-hmm. and also that will put us very quickly into the market, and then we can see where we go from there. But in that way, I think we are sort of similar. Mm-hmm. What we are different is the U.S. market is different than the European market, right? The U.S. market has a lot of great support in terms of government support in the amount of the dollar amount. It's a lot bigger than the support in Europe. And we're not saying we don't have support, but it's a different measurement, right? So for SpaceX to have won to NASA in the very beginning was crucial for their success in the commercial market. And I think that's what we are pushing also in Europe, to be able to have support from governments, European governments, to be able to succeed on the commercial market as well. So, yes, I mean that we are sort of similar in the way that we believe we're going to break through the market, the European market, the same way SpaceX kind of break through the mm-hmm. U.S. market. But we are playing in a different field, because it's mm-hmm. a different time with a different constraints, let's say. We are also risk takers. So in that way, we're similar as well. We want to get to launch as quickly as possible. And obviously we're careful, and reliability, it's our primary goal. But we are doing everything to get to orbit this, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. as fast as we can. What else can I tell you about in terms of comparison, right? We want to, our goals are not just to reach the small satellite market, but to put a much, much bigger mark in space, in European access to space. In terms of future, we see a lot more than just serving the small satellite market. So, mm-hmm. yes, we want to take people to space one day. Yes, we want to go to the moon and beyond. All of that is in our sort of in our blood right now, right? Mm-hmm. So, but we have to start with Spectrum and we believe that that there is a market for that vehicle. Mm-hmm.
So what is, in a nutshell, what is your business model at the moment?
So right now our concentration is Europe, and we do want to make sure that every satellite built in European ground launches in a European launch service provider. So that is definitely our focus, but we do have a point to go worldwide. Obviously, we want to capture the commercial market in Asia, in Latin America, in the US. Obviously, but our concentration is Europe. There is no reason why European satellites have to fly somewhere, with another launcher outside Europe. I mean, it makes no sense. And our business model is to reliability is first, but we need to lower the cost of launch to be able to capture the commercial market. So we are doing everything possible on manufacturing techniques, or the way we are set up company-wide to be able to lower our cost as much as we can to be able to offer the a much better price in the market for Europeans. Yeah.
So when is the first launch scheduled?
So we are actually, our target is second half of next year.
That would be a test launch. So there hasn't been any lift off whatsoever so far.
No. So our test launch would be, we were lucky to, very proud of this. We won the CSTS program, which is, ESA and DLR, funding, provided was 11 million, capacity to be launched in Spectrum for the first two flights. So we have 150 kilogram, aggregate payload to each flight, and that's where we are launching for the first demo flight. So demo one would be second half of 2022, and we'll see how that test goes to see when the next one will be. But hopefully 4 months later, we can launch the second one also with payloads. Actually, yesterday we announced there's an announcement of opportunity that was issued by DLR for payloads that would come under this program. So we could end up with one satellite, or we can end up with, you know, 10, 15 satellites, depending on how big they are. So we're very excited. This is free access to space for our customers, and we want to have the experience. We want to be able to launch payloads and to start this movement to break through. Yeah.
At the moment, I take your very much still in garage style development mode. Very top notch, of course, but I find it highly entertaining that you are testing your engines next to a farm in Bavaria, or at an old farm, that is, right?
And Sweden with a
tractor right next to the shed, to the former cow shed. And you know what? There was a guy on social media who said that he is totally annoyed by your company because because of the noise that you're making all the time when you're testing your engines. So this is, this is as cool as it gets, right? When you're setting something up in your world.
Absolutely. And it has to happen, you know, and we really need to get the support actually from the German government to be able to find the facilities and, you know, the right places to test. I mean, we are building from scratch a testing facility in Sweden, which is huge because, you know, normally it takes a long time, and we are actually, that facility is ongoing already. And, hopefully we'll be able to test from that pretty soon, from that facility pretty soon. So we have, our production facility is very close to our headquarters. So it's not so much of a garage, I would say, not anymore. You should come to the production facility. It's actually pretty cool to see everything there.
Yes, I was blown away when I saw the video you did from the production facility. I mean, like, this is international style technology that's going on. I would expect Elon Musk to walk past the camera. So, but this is completely top notch. What you guys set up here in Bavaria. So,
you know, one of the coolest thing to do for me is I come here every month, right? Every 4 or 5 weeks I'm here. And the first thing I do is go to the factory, because it is amazing what you see every time. I mean, it gets fuller and fuller. It gets more exciting. It gets noisier. There's more people. There's more activity, more machinery. It's very, very cool to watch the growth. Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, we have that facility, which is like 5 kilometers from where I'm seated right now, which is our offices. But then we have the testing facility also about an hour and a half. I haven't been there yet, but I will make it there probably the next trip. And then we have the Swedish facility. And then we signed the contract now with Andoya for the launch site. And that's activities that are starting right now. So we're excited to be launching from there as well.
So Sweden, would that be Kiruna, where the Swedish Kiruna, have their launch?
Yeah.
Okay, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of launch site, Europe is launching out of French Guiana with the Ariane rockets. So mm-hmm. where will you be launching? Out of Munich is, I think, not really possible.
No, so we have a launch. We have agreement with Andoya with Norway to launch mm-hmm. From there, and that would cover probably the SSO orbits flights, which are sort of the standard for the small satellites, mm-hmm. and then we would love to launch from French Guiana as well. We're looking at a second launch site, so that would be great if we could launch from French Guiana. It would be perfect because that would take care of low inclination orbits, which is also a market that is coming up. So mm-hmm. Definitely we would love to continue that and have a launch from there.
Mm-hmm. So just out of curiosity, we had in a former show, we had the vice president of the Shetland Space Center on our show, and they have a launch site, or they're planning to have a launch site, and now there's one in Norway, there's one in Sweden. So how do you decide who to go with? Is it all about the money, or is it about the facilities, or what is it?
Well, I think the first thing, looking at the market and what the market in terms of the different orbits, right? So mm-hmm. Ideally for us would be SSO access. So Norway, it's perfect for that. Mm-hmm. I think that that actually covers the most common orbit right now in the market, mm-hmm. and French Guiana. I mean, we looked at launch sites everywhere in Europe and even in Brazil as well, mm-hmm. because for reaching out to low inclination or going later to GTO or geo orbit, we need to be closer to the equator, preferably. So those launch sites are very attractive. And mm-hmm. Guiana is definitely one that we would love to, since it's under European mm-hmm. base, then definitely it's something that we would love to launch from. But orbit, mm-hmm. it's a big deal. Yes, facilities and experience on launch, right? French Guiana definitely has mm-hmm. a lot of experience on that, so mm-hmm. That would make things easier and faster for us to launch. Norway also has a history of launching, so that always it waits mm-hmm. on our decision too. Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So for your first launch, for the test launch, so what do you expect to happen? I mean, like if you asked Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk or the likes, they would say probably the rocket will explode, the first one. So, I mean, like seriously, when you design a rocket and the more time progresses and technology progresses, does it get ever easier to engineer rockets because technology is maturing and whatnot? Or is it always a high risk project?
Oh, it's definitely high risk, but the whole reason why we want to launch as fast as we can is because you learn the most when launching. You can do all the testing in the world on the ground, sure. and what you get from a flight, it's really, the difference is, yeah, exactly. I mean, so we want to get to launch and we want to learn. This is a very risky and very few companies or rockets, as you say, had made it the first flights being successful or with some minor anomaly. But obviously
prepare for a realistic
flight. Prepare for a for a normal circumstance yeah. or you know, but I think we need to do it. We need to launch. Mm-hmm. We need to get experience in launching. We can't just sit on the ground and you know, and wait until things are, you know, because it never happens, right? Nothing is 100% mm-hmm. perfect until you learn from a launch. So I think, yes, it is risky. And as we change and we upgrade and we, you know, it's always the risk, of putting something new up. But it gets to, I think it will get easier as planes got easier and we don't, you know, we don't question anymore the planes that we're getting in, if they're safe or not, if, you know, we're gonna make it or not. I think we will get to that point. And that's why we actually need to launch more frequently. Mm-hmm. This is the reason why I believe very strongly on ESAR, because the business model that we want is to be able to launch every month, if not every week. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we need to get there. We need to get there so that it becomes, unquestionable how, the safety and reliability of the vehicle. We need to get there. And the only way to do it is just by doing it, by launching. Sure.
So, I don't know if many of all of our listeners are aware of the fact that Germany does have quite a bit of a history when it comes to space and rocketry and rocket engine making. So, of course, that all dates back to Wernher von Braun, to the Saturn V development. Then there was a crazy story happening in Germany with OTRAC, where a guy was determined to set up his own rocket and started launching it out of Africa. So that there's a beautiful a beautiful story behind that, and I highly recommend watching that film. I think it's, I don't know where it plays, somewhere, and just go look for the title "Fly Rocket Fly."
Yes, yes,
a beautiful and dramatic piece of history making. But still, although Bavaria does have Germany has historic experience when it comes to building rockets, and Bavaria is a hotspot for every kind of technology, still, Bavaria does not have vast experience in rocket building. So the thing is, what I would like to know is, where does the expertise come from? Is ESA Aerospace, is that all Bavaria bred expertise, or do you have to import expertise externally?
No, I think obviously we are targeting strongly, you know, all the universities in engineering programs coming from Bavaria. That is something we're doing, you know, on a regular basis. And we're increasing our number of employees to up to 200 by the end of the year, probably. Mm-hmm. We're very close. We're about 150 employees right now. Mm-hmm. So our concentration is definitely young engineers coming from universities out of the region. However, we do have to import in some cases from other European countries that can have expertise in different areas. I think that the more public awareness we create with what we are trying to do, the more interest the young generations will have in the different programs. And therefore, in a few years, we'll be able to have more people coming from, you know, a regional focus, right? So I think it's very, very important, the public awareness, because in general, to be honest, it's in Europe. I mean, it's a big difference between the US and Europe in that sense, in that the US right now is going through this huge sort of excitement about space. In the last, I would say, 10 years, it has increased. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows now about mm-hmm. who's the SpaceX, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody mm-hmm. knows. And everybody gets really excited about it. And therefore, you should see the applications on the space programs for the universities. It has doubled, if not triple. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's what needs to happen here to be able to prepare for what's coming in next. And we want to be sort of the machine to create that. Absolutely. Because we need mm-hmm. to, you know, get to this, the young generation enthusiastic about what we're doing. And we, by launching and doing this, you know, creating this momentum on space, that's how we are going to get the young generation excited.
Sure. So where on the enthusiasm scale are you guys right now when it comes to inspiring younger generations?
Listen, our average age here is 30. Mm-hmm. I actually, you know, I make a big big gap on the curve, but I think I've one of the things that I love about coming here is the enthusiastic on the young people. I mean, they mm-hmm. they really want to change the way things have been done, you know, in general. They want to do things differently, and mm-hmm. they are excited about seeing things being built in one place. I mean, mm-hmm. this is, you know, they take a little bus to the factory and they see, you know, engines being built and tanks getting out of the factory. Mm-hmm. It's exciting. There's more, you know, people bring their, the guys here, they bring their colleagues and their, you mm-hmm. know, classmates and things like that.
Because they're proud.
Exactly. That's the, you know, they love what they're doing and they can see it. They can see it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's amazing what's going on. I see a lot of enthusiasm. I see a lot of passion. There's a lot of passion mm-hmm. about what they're doing. Everybody wants to get to space. They want to launch. They're working really hard to, you know, meet timelines and I think they have everything, to be honest, they have everything to be able to do it, and I think they will and I think this is why investors are excited as well, because they can see that, they can feel, they come here it has happened to me where you come to the office or you go to the factory and you see people happy and you see people working really hard. Nice. I think that's good. And that's good also because, you know, it's contagious. They go and they tell their friends and then their friends get excited and they tell their brothers and sisters and they get into programs and, you know, and that's, it creates a whole cycle and a whole system that we need to be able to succeed.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. So one of the your secrets is that you have a very novel and innovative way to build the rocket, the hardware, and that is you're heavily focusing on 3D printing. So mm-hmm. is this something that the others out there are not so much focusing on, or why do you think that this could be the edge for ESA Aerospace when it comes to competing with the rest of the world?
I think it's about the technology for sure, and you know, there are other companies that are applying the same technology, but I think it's a combination of how you make decisions and the time you process things and how you process things. And I think that's sort of, it's hard to really pinpoint and explain what it is, but decision making, for example, it's interesting because the process to make a decision, traditionally in Europe, there's a lot of parties involved, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to to get to a decision-making process that it's fast and lean, because there's a lot of, you know, while you have engines being built in one place and tanks being built in another, and, you know, you have R&D in another place, etc. It's really hard. I mean, you know, in the US, they've experienced the same thing. So having everything sort of being designed and built here, decision making happens really quickly. If you see something that is being built that, you know, it's for whatever reason, it's not right, or it needs improvement, or, you know, it's slow. You have right there the right people to make a decision to move it and go faster. So technology,
there's no time to wait because technology is evolving, and the,
exactly,
your competitors are not waiting, themselves. So I think there is no time for, wandering, and long decision making.
Yeah, and I think what's really important as well, and this applies obviously to everything, technology, but if you don't continuously work on your R&D while you're building something, you get stuck, right? I mean, you continue to build and you might be successful with what you're building, but if you're not thinking about the future and you're not anticipating, then you kind of, at some point, you get stuck. So, looking, you know, three steps forward at all times, it really is a mentality that helps with how successful, how quickly you adjust to the marketplace, in the future. So I think it's also very, very important to keep this, I'll give you an example. On our last, funding round, the B plus round, where we raised $75 million, that money is been put for, you know, structural production facilities and all of that. But a piece of that is also going to be used to work on reusability. And that is not something that we need to have right at the second, and we don't need it for our first launch, but it's something that we need because we believe that, you know, to be more competitive in the marketplace, we're going to have to take this frequency of launches in a serious mode, and to be able to reuse the vehicle, it's priority to be able to have that frequency. So that's going on, even though it's not something that we need to do when we need to have it right now to be successful on the launch side. So it's one of the things that I think, yes, 3D printing and other technologies will come along, but if you don't have if you cannot take the decision to move forward with certain technologies or certain ways of doing things, then you go nowhere. You can have the best technology in the world, but if you're not using it and you're not, you know, making decisions on it, then it's worth nothing, right?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. It's also interesting to see where venture capital comes from, because usually or traditionally venture capital would mostly or very often go into software applications and whatnot. And suddenly there is money flowing into the space industry, especially in Europe. So that's an interesting development to see. So can you talk a little bit about where the money comes from and what, how you see that shift in mentality when it comes to venture capital funding and sourcing?
Yeah, I think there's a change in general in the space industry. And you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of technology, sort of heavy technology investors, traditional technology investors, were the big players in space. And now you can see service companies, you can see companies that are thinking about extending their product lines in some ways that they see space as part of their business plans, you know. So it is changing, and it needs to change, actually, because space in general will become a big part of everybody's, and it is already a big part of everybody's life, but it will continue to increase So this is where you find, you know, when you'll see your phones hooked to satellites, then you're going to realize who's behind that investment, because that's what they're going to need to add a service to your phone. Or, you know, if, I mean, anything, right? Observing just earth conservation in terms of defense and all of that, you have to see who's behind the, not only the technology, but the service that you're providing to the final customer, to understand who's behind the actual funding for that technology. And I think it's important to also to approach the investment community with the service in mind, and not not just on with the technology in mind. So the final customer and what you know, how the final customer is benefiting and how you benefit from that new service, than just focusing on technology. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It makes more than sense. Absolutely. On the other hand, one could also think that Germany could have an interesting window to find a replacement for its, I wouldn't say broken, but the automotive industry in Germany is experiencing a special situation, because Germany has always produced or has always been a world leader in that respect. And now the electric wave is rolling around the planet and is producing new challenges. So do you think that the space industry could be some sort of new German industry in the future?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, absolutely. Not only to help also the automotive industry, but there's other industries where space will play a key role, right? So I think, yes, I mean, that's definitely, this is where it's, sort of frustrating a little bit in terms of accessing support, right? Because for us, having access to space is very clear, the benefits of what that brings to the different industries. It's hard for the general public, and this is where the frustration comes, right? It's really hard for the general public to understand that unless there is a branding built up, right? So how do we help the automotive industry? How do we help, you know, the phone industry, telecommunications, or, you know, defense, or, you know, whatever, I mean, whichever industry, retail, you know, I mean, anything, right? How do you help if the general public doesn't have access to understanding how space helps, then how do we, you know, push those industries to benefit from it, right? So I think if Germany were to focus on the space industry now, as we are, you know, sort of, you know, how do you say, launching this initiative on space in general, I think that once they support that and they concentrate on making that big, every other industry will actually increase as well in their potential. But you know, how do we change the focus, or how do we you know, how do we convince the government to put more emphasis in space is only by branding in space in general and making, you know, people understand the benefits of space in general. I do think that, you know, there is like what's happening in the US right now, right? In terms of, people understand the benefits in general. I think it needs to happen here as well. And not just, you know, not just the phone, which is the easiest part to understand for everybody, because everybody is, you know, hooked to a phone. But I mean, everything, you know, medicine, you know, everything we do. I mean, how do we make governments understand that by supporting space, they're supporting other industries?
I'm sorry, Alexa. No, Alexa is talking to me right now that I have to water my flowers.
That's great.
Seriously.
That's great. Right.
That's a funny break. All right. Thank you, Alexa. But there's, of course, you mentioned a growing momentum when it comes to space services, and then you're planning on launching every week. There's the obvious question that needs to be asked. How do you deal with the space debris problem? So is that something that is of no interest to you, because you're saying this is not my thing? I'm here to provide services to go into space, into orbit. But how do we deal with that? I mean, like, if you bring on a weekly basis stuff into orbit that produces perhaps questions and challenges. So how does an upcoming big player in the space industry deal with such a question?
Yeah, I think there's a different programs that we can help with. We help having access to space, we are also helping other technologies to flourish, right? So technologies, for example, for debris removal, we still need to put those technologies up in space to be able to remove space. So, I mean, I think we want to be a big player on that part of the market. The way we're building the vehicle, we're also taking into consideration reusability as well. It's a big deal too, right? To decrease the amount of debris. Also, we are not creating any debris actually, because we're, you know, deorbiting our vehicle. So it's not debris per se. But we want to be a big player in debris removal, in helping other technologies to come in play to help with the debris situation, for sure. And I think that it's a launch service provider. It's absolutely essential for doing that. And that's how. And you know, we want to also be part of how we see debris as well. So in terms of regulations and initiatives to companies that are helping in that area, we want to be facilitating that.
You know what? Maybe this sounds stupid, but if you go on a boat, or whitewater rafting, you're forced to use a life vest, okay, by whoever you're doing the whitewater rafting tour with. Now, it could be interesting as a business model for ESAR Aerospace to say, for whoever wants to fly with us, your CubeSat people and whatnot, we will only take you if you're using our deorbiting life vest technology. Because, I mean, like, that could be a huge incentive, considering awareness for space debris and considering awareness for sustainability. And maybe there's some technology that can just be piggybacking on a small CubeSat and help him deorbit whenever its time is ready.
Yeah, I think this is when I say that we want to be, you know, supporting some initiatives. This is exactly what I'm talking about. I mean, there has to be some sort of incentive, right, for those companies to. I give you an example, right? I mean, how about if you are a technology that is going to help remove some debris in space, you get to launch first, for example,
right? Absolutely.
Or I don't know. There's so many ways that we can, so many commercial models that we can work on. But definitely, I mean, this is something that we're thinking constantly on how we can improve or facilitate companies and technologies that, are helping with the issue. They're going to need launchers. I mean, we have to be there, and we can do our part by incentives, for example. That's actually something we're thinking about.
Mm. Nice. Stella, we are at the end of our beautiful conversation. We do have, though, a final question to ask, and this is a Space Cafe podcast, a coffee place, so to say. And in coffee places, people sometimes go to have an espresso to energize themselves. Now, let's have an espresso for the mind. So what is it that you would like to share as an espresso for the mind for our audience?
I would say especially to young people coming out of school, no idea is crazy idea. Every idea is, it should come with passion, and every idea is actually a positive thing, right? You're thinking about something that is not existence. Therefore, it's a good idea. So I think that, not to be afraid to speak up and to say what you have in mind in terms of these crazy ideas. I think it's important. It's important because, we can contain, how do you say this? You can contain people's, wants or needs in terms of intellectual, prosperity, right, in their heads, right? So if a young person comes out of school with something that it could sound completely out of this world, and you think it's crazy, and therefore you can't put it out there because you're afraid that they're gonna laugh at you or that they're gonna, I would say that's only in one's mind, put it out and go for it, because we need more of that. We need more of that. We need to stop being reactive and start being more proactive on creating things for the future. So I would encourage everybody to talk and say and present what they have in mind.
Nice. You know what? The funny thing is, it took me now almost an hour to realize that your first name is Stella and you're in the space industry.
Yes, you're a big star. Well, my mom used to make a joke. Estrella, which is, star, can also, in Spanish, when you conjugate the verb estrellar, you can also make it sound like it bumps into something. You're estrellada. So that's what my mom used to say. You're not Stella, but you're estrellada, you know?
Right. Wonderful. Thank you so much for that extremely inspiring hour. Thank you so much, Stella.
Thank you, Marcos. It's a huge pleasure. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, everyone, for being here today. And keep an eye out for the space guys and gals in Bavaria. That would be something if we in Europe could finally stand up to the Elons and Jeffs and Richards. I would like that. Go, ISAR. Otherwise, I'd like to draw your attention to a few other things worth looking out for. The family of local space cafes, for example, is growing and growing. Scotland, Germany, Brazil, Australia. This is just the beginning. Jump over to the mothership on Spacewatch Global and see if there's something for you. Otherwise, I'm looking forward to next time. Stay tuned.